of a strategy: low cost, differentiated, dual advantage. But it's not just about what type of advantage you seek. There's also the question of what is the scope of your firm? What is your competitive scope? And here, you can think about being a very focused firm, what we call a niche competitor, where you've chosen a particular product category in which to compete with a fairly narrow product line. You've focused on a particular geography, and you have a fairly narrow customer segment that you're trying to serve, what we call a narrow target market. But you don't have to be a focused competitor. You could choose to be a broad competitor. You could offer a wide array of products. You could compete in an expansive geographical setting, perhaps even be a global player. And you could serve a wider target market with many customers of different demographic background, of different income, etc. So what type of advantage do you seek? That low-cost differentiation choice. And what's your scope? How focused or how broad are you in terms of product, geography, and customer? These are the fundamental choices that every firm must make as it chooses its strategy, as it chooses how do I want to position myself within my external environment to mitigate any negative forces and to take advantage of the opportunities there so that I can achieve more economic value, create more of that than my competition. So let's go into this in a little more detail. When we think about competitive advantage, we always start with who is the average competitor in my industry and how much economic value are they creating? What is the gap between the willingness to pay for their product and the costs for that firm to deliver that product to their customers? What kind of wedge is there between willingness to pay and cost for the average firm in my industry? Now, what am I trying to achieve if I want competitive advantage? Well, I'm trying to generate a higher wedge, a larger wedge between willingness to pay and cost than my competition. I'm trying to generate more economic value. How can I do that? Well, let's start by looking at how a differentiated firm does that. How does Mercedes do that? Well, they're trying to create much higher perceived value. They're trying to generate much higher willingness to pay than Chevrolet. But what about their costs? Well, their costs are going to be slightly higher than a brand like Chevrolet, right? It's going to cost more for that quality German engineering, for the luxurious look and feel of the automobile. So their costs are going to be higher than the competition. But the goal, if they want to be a successful differentiated player, is to have much higher willingness to pay, but only slightly higher costs, such that the wedge between willingness to pay and cost is higher than the competition, is larger than the competition. What does a successful low-cost player do? Well, they're trying to drive their costs much lower than their rivals. Now, they're going to sacrifice a little bit of willingness to pay. They're not going to be able to charge the same prices that the competition is charging. But hopefully, they're not sacrificing too much on price, and they're driving costs much, much lower. If they can do that, they've achieved a larger gap, a larger wedge between willingness to pay and cost. They've generated more economic value than their rivals. So two paths to creating that larger wedge between willingness to pay and cost: differentiation and low cost. Well, there is a third way to achieve competitive advantage. That's what we call dual advantage. That's where you both have a higher perceived value and a lower cost structure than your competition. Well, is that easy to achieve? Well, Michael Porter, in his seminal work on strategy, argued that dual advantage was very, very difficult to achieve, if not impossible. And I would concur, not saying impossible, but it's very unlikely. Why is it so difficult to do? Well, because if you're trying to achieve that higher willingness to pay and create more perceived value, well, it's going to cost you some money. You're going to have to invest in research and development, in branding, in quality components. It's hard to have much lower costs than your competition if you're trying to create a premium product. Likewise, if you're trying to bring your costs down significantly, you're going to find that it may be difficult to still command the same brand image and the same position in the market and be able to achieve the same pricing. And players that are very focused on either differentiation or low cost may be able to really attack you. You know, if you're trying to achieve this, sell this vehicle, and you're saying it's a premium vehicle at a high price, and yet you're trying to have lower costs than the competition, well, Mercedes may come in there and really attack you and start to critique the quality of your vehicles. Similarly, there may be a player that comes in and undercuts you on price, and they're able to do that because they have such a strong cost position. So the players who are focused on either differentiation or low cost tend to be able to attack people trying to achieve dual advantage. It's why dual advantage is so difficult to achieve. Not impossible, but a dangerous place to try to play, particularly for a firm that has many very tough competitors in their market. Now, interestingly, the financials tell us a story when we're analyzing the company. We can actually look at the financial statements and perceive or pick out from that precisely what type of competitive advantage they're trying to achieve. Let's take Walmart and Target, two major players in the mass merchandising business in retail in the United States and for Walmart around the globe. If you look at Walmart's financials relative to Target, you'll notice some really interesting and stark differences. Walmart has much lower gross margins than Target. They have lower overhead costs, lower selling, general, and administrative expenses. But they have much higher asset turnover than Target. They utilize their fixed assets more efficiently. They turn their inventory much more quickly than Target. When we look at these real differences in financial measures, are we simply saying, well, is one firm better than the other? It turns out both Target and Walmart generate very strong returns for their shareholders, or have over the last few decades. But what's interesting when we look at the financials is we notice they've taken a very different path to achieving success. Both successful firms, but very different approaches. What does that mean? Well, Target, high gross margins, lower returns, a typical differentiation strategy. Why do they have higher margins? They've chosen, right, to sell a slightly higher quality good, sell more fashionable items, try to set some higher prices in some of those categories. For example, when they produce apparel collections in collaboration with famous designers, they're trying to bring a slightly premium price to that category in the mass merchandising business. But they have lower inventory turns. Why? They sell fewer of the basics than Walmart. They sell a few more of these fashion-forward items. And so those items may not sell as frequently as some of the very basic, low-price items that Walmart sells. On the other hand, for Walmart, a lower-margin business, always trying to have rock-bottom prices, but very high turns. They're good at selling staples, basic products that you buy every day. You're going to go into that store very often, and so they're going to turn that inventory very quickly. Moreover, they're going to pack items in the store. The aisles aren't going to be quite as wide. The layout not quite as clean. It's more stack them high and let them fly at Walmart. And that is reflected in the higher inventory turns and the higher asset utilization that we see. What's the point? The financials tell us a story. They tell us not just which firms are better than others. They also tell us what kind of strategy is that firm trying to achieve and is it doing so successfully. So if we looked at Nordstrom in the retail business and compared its financials to TJX, the parent company of Marshalls and TJ Maxx, we also would see a very different story. One generating high gross margins, having higher selling, general, and administrative expenses, though, and perhaps accepting lower inventory turnover. That would be Nordstrom. And then we'd see TJX, very low expenses, but lower gross margins, charging lower prices, but turning their assets, utilizing their assets very efficiently, and therefore achieving high profitability in that way. Different paths to success. So if we put together what we've learned so far, we can see that there are four basic, what Porter calls, generic competitive strategies. There's the broad differentiated strategy, Starbucks, a wide target market competing in many geographies with a differentiated product, a premium priced product in the coffee business. Ducati, on the other hand, they're a focused differentiator. Ducati in the motorcycle business, based in Italy, serving a very narrow target market with a limited selection of products, right? Very much a niche player in the motorcycle business. Contrast this then with the low-cost strategies we might employ, either broad or focused. A broad low-cost player would be Walmart, right? Serving a wider range of customers in many geographies with many products and services. On the other hand, in the focused low-cost category, we'd have a firm like Irish-based airline Ryanair, serving certain geographies with a very well-defined product set and very much a narrower target market than major airlines like British Airways or Alitalia. So which is the best of these four generic strategies? Which should we pursue? Well, the answer is there is no one best strategy, but there is one place you don't want to be, and that's stuck in the middle, like JCPenney. Unclear as to whether you're really a differentiated player or a low-cost player, whether you're a niche player or a broad player. That's the real danger that we want to avoid. Well, how do you become stuck in the middle? Well, first is you simply fail to choose. You're trying to be all things to all people. And we certainly know some companies trying to do that. They're so desperate for growth, for top-line growth in terms of revenue, that they are expanding and moving and trying to be everything to all their customers, and they're not clear on their strategy. Well, you also kind of have the issue of trying to move from one box to the other. Shifting your strategy may cause you to not actually achieve the shift, but end up straying and stuck in the middle. Consider Starbucks in the period from, say, 2000 to 2008. Starbucks began, of course, as a niche player, a focused differentiator. They set out to grow and become more of a broad differentiator, but as they did that, they lost a little of their soul. They diluted their brand a bit. Howard Schultz, the founder, was no longer CEO at the time. But he, in 2008, he saw the writing on the wall. He saw the dangerous place that Starbucks found itself in. He stepped back in as CEO. And he noticed, he said, I don't think we're about coffee anymore. He noticed, for example, that when he walked into the stores, there were lots of other items in the stores besides coffee, crowding the identity of the store, pushing coffee to the side to some extent. He even didn't smell coffee, he said, when he went into the store. In an effort to become a broader player to serve the mass market, they diluted the brand. And of course, what's interesting is Schultz brought them back to the coffee roots, and they've had more success in recent years. But there are other examples of companies trying to move from one box to the other that get into trouble. Pierre Cardin and Gucci, both focused differentiators, also as they tried to grow, found themselves diluting their brand to some extent in certain periods of their history. And finally, the third way you might find yourself stuck in the middle is you're trying to react to the emergence of a new competitor, and you end up straddling different competitive positions because you're moving in many different directions, trying to adapt to a really tough new rival in your market who may be taking market share and profits away from you. So let's take a look at this issue of straddling, this idea of finding yourself caught between two fundamentally different competitive positions and how it happens. An example will really help us. So let's take a look at the airline business again. And what's interesting about this is to look at the legacy carriers, mainline carriers like Delta, United, Continental, and British Airways. How did they react to the emergence of new low-cost rivals like Southwest Airlines in the U.S., or like Ryanair or EasyJet in Europe? Well, interestingly, many of the legacy carriers decided to create new subsidiaries, low-cost subsidiaries that would compete directly with companies like Southwest or like Ryanair. So Delta created a unit called Song. United created a unit called TED. Continental created Continental Light. And British created a subsidiary, British Airways did, called Go. What were they trying to achieve with each of these units? Well, they were trying to compete aggressively with this low-cost rival without having to change their fundamental business model for their main airline. And so they created these units, gave them a little bit of independence, but not complete independence, and let them try to compete. But did they really create something that was as effective as these rivals that had entered their market? Did Delta really create something that was as good as Southwest? Did British Airways really create something that was as good as EasyJet or Ryanair? In fact, what you found in each of those cases is they straddled. They created something that had elements of their old model and elements of the new model the competitors had used. But in creating something that was a bit of a hybrid, it was neither as effective as the old model nor as effective as these new upstarts that had entered the market. So we had British Airways, for example, with Go. Well, they weren't willing to go quite so far as to not have assigned seats the way Ryanair did. They weren't willing to eliminate food altogether. They would offer good food, but try to charge for it. So they were making these compromises, creating a model that was neither as good as what they had or what had entered the market to compete with them. They straddled. And as a result, all of those new units established by legacy airlines, they all failed. None of them were successful. We see the same issue with how IBM reacted to the emergence of Dell in the personal computer business. IBM was selling standardized products through a massive distribution channel, both at the retailer and wholesaler level. They had large factories achieving economies of scale, pumping out huge volumes of the same products. Dell, creating customized products, mass customization, if you will, selling them only over the phone or online, not selling through retailers or wholesalers at all. Two very different strategies. How did IBM initially react to the emergence of Dell? Did they create a separate unit to strictly sell computers over the phone or on the internet? No, they tried to create a hybrid. They tried to ship partially assembled computers out to their wholesalers, who then could perhaps customize for some of their corporate clients. They straddled. They created something neither as effective as their old model, nor quite as effective as that new model that Dell had founded in a dorm room in Texas. They straddled. So competitive advantage is an interesting thing. It's not about doing one thing well, right? It's not about what you often hear of as the term core competence. Competitive advantage is about a whole system of capabilities, an integrated, self-reinforcing system of activities that enable you to achieve advantage. A collection, an interconnected set of capabilities, resources, and choices. So crafting an effective strategy means you have to be different, not just copy the assortment of resources and capabilities that your rivals have achieved. You've either got to perform activities differently or perform different activities. That's the key if you want to achieve advantage. There is no silver bullet, no one thing that you can do better than the competition and therefore achieve long-term advantage. Why is this idea of interconnectedness or fit among your choices so important? Well, the idea is that one choice you make enhances the value of other choices you make. One capability you develop creates a stronger capability elsewhere in the organization. If these capabilities and choices fit together well, not only can you create a powerful advantage, it can be really hard for others to copy that system of activities. To understand this in a little more detail, let's take a look at Walmart's value chain. Looking back at their original strategy, what are some of the key choices that they made as they grew in the 1960s and 70s and 80s to be the most formidable retailer in the world? Well, they had an everyday low price strategy. Very few sales, everything always at low prices. They had little national advertising. They weren't doing a lot of new stores in urban areas. They were focused in rural locations. They had satellite technology to connect their corporate office in Bentonville, Arkansas, with the stores in these rural areas. They grew not by hopscotching around the country, but instead by creating a dense network of stores built around distribution centers that they had opened. They had very frugal travel policies and no regional offices, as many of their competitors did. So think about that for a moment. Each of those choices made reinforced other choices. So having an everyday low price strategy fit very well with not doing a lot of national advertising. No need to advertise sales if you don't run a lot of sales, if you operate with everyday low prices. You want to have a highly efficient logistics system and distribution system. Well, everyday low pricing creates very predictable demand, and therefore it's much easier to run a very powerful and seamless integrated logistics system. So each of these choices fit together. Now think about what would happen if a competitor like Kmart tried to emulate Walmart. What competitors often do is they look at what you do and they look at what they think you do best. And they emulate one part of the system. Oh, Walmart's really good at supply chain. They're really good at logistics. And they try to copy that. Two mistakes inherent in that attempt by a firm like Kmart. Number one, it isn't the one thing that Walmart does that's a silver bullet. It's how their logistics plan and system fits with everything else they do that creates advantage. But secondly, you at Kmart, well, you have your own system of activities that's quite different than Walmart's. So taking one thing out of the Walmart system and trying to drop it into your system, you can't achieve the same power, the same advantage. You end up with some things that don't fit together quite so nicely. So if you think about why this is so important, this idea of fit and how these activities fit together, it's important because rivals, first of all, sometimes face what we call causal ambiguity. They don't really understand how all these activities fit together to create advantage. Secondly, they try to copy one piece of what you do instead of understanding the need to copy the whole thing. They also have made very different commitments than you have and very different trade-offs than you have. Therefore, it's difficult for them to alter those. Historical commitments are often rigid, and that rigidity prevents them from copying you. So fit's a great thing if you can create this really well-aligned, self-reinforcing system of activities. Of course, the challenge is, if you've done that very well and you've tailored your activities to one set of customers and one market, what if you try to grow? What if you try to move into a new segment? Will you now face the problem that your strategy and your system of activities doesn't actually fit so well in this new market that you're trying to enter? This is a problem many companies face, and we'll take a look in a moment at how Walmart faced that when they moved from their normal retailing business into the wholesale club business. But first, a little note about IKEA, a very successful company in the furniture business. What's interesting about that is one of their CEOs at one point said that many competitors had tried to copy one or two of the things IKEA did well. And the problem is they didn't try to understand the totality of the system that enabled IKEA to perform so effectively. So they tried to copy Scandinavian design, or they tried to copy the store experience, or they tried to copy the idea of having the customer assemble the furniture at home. They didn't understand that it's how all of those things fit together that created such an advantage for IKEA. So let's take a look at a company that was successful in one market, that moved into another and found that that very system of activities, which was so well interconnected, so well aligned, now suddenly didn't fit the external opportunity in front of them. So you have to ask the question, why has Costco outperformed Walmart in the wholesale club business? Now, Walmart has a very good business. Sam's Club is very effective and profitable, but it's not nearly as profitable and successful as Costco. Why did Walmart, who had this great value chain, this great system of activities, why do they struggle when they try to apply it to a business that's also about selling things at low prices, isn't it? Isn't the wholesale club business actually quite similar to what Walmart had thrived and succeeded in so well over the years? Turns out maybe not. Actually, the customer in the wholesale club business is a little different than in the basic Walmart business. It's a little higher wealth customer. Now, why would that be? Why does Costco attract people of higher income than a typical Walmart store? What's different about the wholesale club business? Well, you have to pay a fee each year to be able to shop there. And when you shop there, while things might be great values, you have to spend more on each trip, more of a total cash outlay because you're buying in bulk. And how do you get those goods home? Well, you need a big vehicle to get them home, and then you need to live in a big house to be able to store all those products. So put that all together, the annual fee and the bulk buying and the big house and the large car, and you see where suddenly the typical customer at Costco isn't quite the same as at Walmart. And what did Costco do well? They built a system of activities tailored to the customer driving the Volvo or the BMW, not the Chevy. They built a store experience that was different than Sam's Club because they understood it was a different customer. Sam's Club was too tied down by the legacy of Walmart to truly serve in a unique way this different set of customers. You see, here is the problem. It's difficult to create a great value chain and to create a great system of activities that's well connected, but it's also difficult to move that to a new market at times. The other problem you face, of course, is you've tailored your activities to a particular environment, you've done really well, and then the world changes. And now suddenly, your strategy, which fit very well in the environment and was successful, now you're the one that's become rigid. You've got capabilities and choices you've made and commitments you've made that are hard to undo. The idea of historical commitments that become rigid is a fundamental one because it's often our explanation for why incumbent players aren't nimble enough, flexible enough, to adapt to a changing environment. This leads us to an important concept to close out our lecture called judo strategy. Judo strategy. Because core capabilities can become rigid, successful entrepreneurs, successful entrants, often are able to use an incumbent's strengths against them. That's a key principle in judo, using the strength of your competitor against them. Consider the case of Dell versus IBM. What were IBM's strengths? Well, it had tremendous manufacturing capability to produce high volumes of the standardized product at low cost. It also had tremendous relationships with the distribution channel, with retailers, with wholesalers, with value-added resellers. Well, what did Dell do? By building its strategy very differently, now this very strength that IBM had became a liability. IBM couldn't go direct and sell online. If it did so, it would alienate many of the wholesalers it had been working with and many of the retailers. So IBM was hesitant to go online as quickly as Dell did. IBM's factories weren't configured to build customized products every day based on customer demand. They were configured to produce large batches of standardized products as efficiently as possible. So IBM's strengths now became liabilities as they tried to adapt to this nimble new entrant. Judo strategy. Take advantage of the strengths of your competitor and turn them against that rival. There are many threats that come to a competitive advantage if you achieve it successfully. The ability to be successful as a firm, to be more profitable than your rivals, is about not just achieving advantage, but sustaining it. And to sustain it, you have to be worried about three major external threats. Can someone imitate what you're doing, but do it better than you? Can a substitute emerge, an alternative product or service that undermines your position? So can a tablet computer supplant the laptop for many consumers? And hold up. What is hold up? Hold up is when your buyers and suppliers gain leverage over you and grab more of the profit pie. It's like a convenience store hold up, right? They've got a gun to your head. They have leverage and they're able to extract some profit from you, like Microsoft did from the personal computer makers by having such a powerful position in the operating system market. So imitation, substitution, and hold up are the three main external threats. From an internal basis, of course, we can shoot ourselves in the foot if we don't perceive and react to threats in an adequate fashion. And incumbent players sometimes don't see the threat early enough, or they don't know how to respond, or they can't motivate their organization to respond quickly enough when threats emerge. One thing you'll note about strategies in many markets is that we actually aren't trying to be as different as we should in many companies. If strategy is about identifying different activities and different positions in the marketplace, what we see in many markets is strategies converging. We see herd behavior, companies simply imitating one another. Why is that? It's safe to follow the herd. There's risk aversion on the part of many executives. Being really different can be risky. Benchmarking is widespread, so people are constantly looking at their competitors and trying to identify what they do well, and then they copy them. And as growth slows in the market and we compete for market share, we're no longer going after new customers, but trying to steal old ones from our rivals, we start to do things that are similar to our rivals. So herd behavior, unfortunately, is chronic and exists in many industries, even though it's the antithesis of a great competitive strategy. I'll close with a couple of quotes. There's one great quote from Alan J. Lerner who wrote, "You write a hit the same way you write a flop." Right? Success sows the seeds of its own destruction. A firm that's been really successful in one market, that's built a great system of activities, can see those same strengths become a liability because the commitments they've made become rigid and they're unable to change as the environment changes around them. Well, John Maynard Keynes also wrote something very interesting that pertains to the issue of strategy, though he was an economist. He said, "The difficulty lies not in the new ideas, but in escaping from the old ones, which ramify for those brought up, as most of us have been, into every corner of our minds. It's hard to change the way you think. And for many companies, they've got one way they think about how to make money in a business, and they can't shake that when someone comes along with a new model, as we'll see in upcoming lectures. So your assignment. Look at the annual reports of two companies before our next lecture, Whole Foods and Kroger, both in the supermarket business. Take a look at the financial statements. How do their key ratios differ? Things like their return on assets, their net income margin, their gross margin, their inventory turnover. And how do those differences reflect the contrasting strategies of these two firms? Which firm is pursuing a differentiation strategy and which is pursuing the low-cost strategy?
This lecture is titled, What Trader Joe's Doesn't Do.
Suppose you were an investor, and several decades ago, a Stanford MBA named Joe Colomb came to you and requested an investment in his new grocery retailer. He described the retailer he envisioned operating. They were going to be very small stores, fairly cramped aisles, small parking lots. He envisioned opening these in low-rent, beat-up strip malls where he could have low rent for his space. He wanted to offer a limited selection of goods, not nearly as many as the typical supermarket. He didn't want to sell any branded goods. He wanted to only sell private label. He wasn't going to accept coupons and do any television advertising. He didn't envision a loyalty card or any self-checkout lines. He didn't really envision sales. He didn't even want to have inserts in the Sunday newspaper with advertisements about what was on sale that week at his firm. Would you have invested in Joe Colombe's new grocery retailer? I suspect many of you would not have, and you would have made a big mistake, like many others did at the time, because Joe Colombe opened a chain named Trader Joe's that went on to become one of the most successful grocery retailers, really retailers of any kind, over the last few decades. Now, the Albrecht family of Germany, they believed in Joe Colombe. They actually bought his firm. The Albrecht family owned a chain of grocers in Germany and other places in Europe called Aldi. And they acquired Trader Joe's, leaving Joe Colombe to run the stores as his CEO. And great success followed. In fact, this company has passionate fans. It's incredible the lengths to which people will go to demonstrate their love for Trader Joe's. Facebook pages have been created trying to get people at the company to open a store somewhere close to the owner of that Facebook page. There have been people that have gone on Twitter and created accounts describing the, quote, yummy, healthy Trader Joe's items on their shopping list. That's the at Trader Joe's list Twitter handle. She has more than 55,000 followers. A customer has created a If I Made a Commercial for Trader Joe's homemade video on their smartphone, and they've accumulated 925,000 people who viewed the video. It's incredible to see the amount of attention that the firm has gotten from these passionate fans. There have even people who've written cookbooks featuring meals prepared strictly with the firm's products. People wait in line for hours before a new store grand opening. Joe Colombe has once said, I own the cult. He says, my children say that the Albrechts own the business, but I own the cult. It truly is a cult-like, passionate following. Trader Joe's doesn't have customers. They have fans. And any company would love to have fans, not just customers. It's interesting to watch how the firm has succeeded and how much attention it's gotten for its success. In 2013, they've been ranked highly in a number of measures by a number of different periodicals. They are considered one of the most successful grocers in the United States. For example, their sales per square foot is said to exceed that of most major grocery chains, even significantly higher than top performers such as Whole Foods Market. Customers ranked it their favorite supermarket in the U.S. in a 2013 survey. Consumer Reports ranked it as the second best supermarket in the nation. Fast Company gave it high marks for innovation, and Forbes lists the company as one of the top 25 firms to work for in 2013. Trader Joe's claimed that 80% of its customers had attended college. The company described its target market as intelligent, educated, and inquisitive individuals. It had a very clear view of who its customer was and how it wanted to serve that customer. They focused on people who were health conscious, enjoyed travel, and like trying new things. Tony Hales, a store captain, as they call their managers, described the clientele. He said, our favorite customers are out-of-work college professors. Well-read, well-traveled, appreciates a good value. Industry consultant Kevin Kelly described the target customer as, quote, a Volvo-driving professor who could be CEO of a Fortune 100 company if he could get over his capitalist angst. I seem to see a pattern here. Professors like me seem to love Trader Joe's. But I don't love Trader Joe's just because of the in-store experience. I love it because it's a high performer. Not only does it have passionate fans, but it's returned tremendous profits for its investors over the years. It succeeded by creating a place where people want to work, where customers want to shop, and where investors want to put their money. How have they done it? How is this upstart from California, owned by a German corporate parent, outcompeted many formidable rivals in the supermarket business? They've known their customer. They've known them very well. That's certainly one first step. A little more about the Trader Joe's customer. I think it's interesting. There was a Los Angeles Times article several years ago about them, and it wrote, these are people who wear sunscreen even over their tattoos, who travel frequent flyer miles, and with the Lonely Planet guide rather than Frommer's. You know, it's people who really love to shop there, but who are quirky, who are different. They want something other than the usual supermarket, and they found it in Trader Joe's. And the cult-like following is demonstrated when they open a new store. People waiting in line overnight in Spokane, Washington. People were there from 3 o'clock in the morning. People taking days off from work to pitch their tent-like chairs and their setup overnight so they can stay there and wait for the doors to open. People flocking and forming long lines. In certain cities, they've even had to bring police in to manage the traffic around a new store because so many people flood there on the first day. In Manhattan, when they opened a new store, the lines wound around the block. And again, police had to help manage the flow. And they could only let certain amounts of people in the store at once because so many wanted to get in at the same time when the doors opened. Well, what's the secret? How do you create a company that has such a passionate following and that's done so well for its employees, its customers, and its investors? Well, let's list for a moment what Trader Joe's does not do. The things that most other grocery stores typically do that Trader Joe's does not. They don't offer many branded products. It's almost all private label. Actually, with very funny names, right? It's Trader Joe's private label. As they produce foods from other countries, they simply translate Joe into that language and apply that. So Trader Jose for Mexican food, Trader Jacques for French food, etc. They don't have spacious parking lots. They don't have spacious stores with wide aisles. They don't offer self-checkout or TV ads. They don't accept coupons or have a loyalty card. They don't really run sales and no TV advertisements. And interestingly, they don't have a large selection. A typical Trader Joe's location might have 3,000 or 4,000 items in it. A typical supermarket, like one run by Kroger, might have 30,000 or 40,000 items in it. And finally, there is not a stable product line at Trader Joe's. Products come and go. This week you go there and you love their mango salsa. Next week you go and it may not be there. Not because they're out of stock, but because they've moved on and they're offering a different item in that space. Well, what's the lesson from this company that's choosing not to do all these things that a typical grocery store would do? Well, Michael Porter once wrote, "The essence of strategy is choosing what not to do." You can't be all things to all people. And to not be all things to all people, it means really identifying not just what you're going to do, but understanding what you're not going to do. Being very clear about the things that rivals are offering that you're choosing not to offer. Why is this so important? What is the value of this concept of making trade-offs? Well, trade-offs offer several key advantages. First, they make you distinct. The more that you've chosen a very different set of activities and a different set of offerings than your competition, the more you're unlike them, the more you're different. And that's important, as we've said in prior lectures. But even more than that, making trade-offs, choosing carefully what not to do, makes it very hard for existing players to imitate you. And that's important because not only do you have to be able to achieve competitive advantage to generate high returns, you have to sustain that advantage. You can't be easily imitated if you want to have long-term success. And making trade-offs, choosing what not to do, can actually make it very difficult for others to emulate you. And finally, making trade-offs can help you mitigate the negative forces in your industry. They can help you deal with high buyer power or high supplier power or strong threats from things like substitutes. So choosing what not to do makes you distinct, hard to be imitated, and can help you mitigate negative forces in your industry. All important if you're going to achieve long-term success. Think about the strategies of some leading firms in past decades. Southwest Airlines, eHarmony, Edward Jones, and Planet Fitness. Southwest succeeding in the tough airline business. eHarmony succeeding in the online dating market, creating a marketplace where people can match and find people they're interested in having a long-term relationship with. Edward Jones, a brokerage house, competing with the likes of Merrill Lynch and others, very successful over the last few decades. In Planet Fitness, in that very difficult fitness center business, they've done very well. How have these firms done it? Well, take Southwest. No assigned seats, smaller regional airports, not having multiple jets in their fleet. They only have one kind of plane. Not offering inter-service. You can't transfer your bags to other airlines. Not operating a hub-and-spoke system, instead offering point-to-point service between certain airports. They've chosen to not do what many major airlines have done. eHarmony, choosing not to be in the business of casual dating matches. They're not trying to find that one-night stand for you. They're not trying to find that person you might date for a month and then move on to find someone else. They're trying to get people married. to establish and help people establish long-term relationships. And they've done some things to actually push away the casual dater from their site. How about Edward Jones? They don't offer online brokerage services. They don't want you trading online. They don't want to sell initial public offerings, commodities, penny stocks. They don't offer a huge array of investment banking services, as many other brokerage houses also do. They've chosen to be the trusted advisor to conservative clientele who are interested in long-term investing. And they've made a set of trade-offs to distinguish themselves from the competition. And finally, Planet Fitness. They're sort of the gym for people who aren't fitness freaks, the gym for people who get put off by fitness centers that cater to people who are incredibly into their regimen. They want people who are just trying to lose a few pounds or get in a little better shape, and they're just interested in a place that's safe, that won't make them feel awkward and the like. And you see in their ads how they've exemplified in their advertisements this strategy of trade-offs, right? The great ad where this really buff man comes in with bulging muscles, and they ask him what he wants from his fitness center, and he says, I pick things up and I put them down. And he repeats that 3 or 4 times, and eventually they escort him out of the building. They don't want him as a customer. How many companies do you know create advertisements that say, these are people we don't want as customers? That is the ultimate strategy of making trade-offs. But by doing that, they make themselves even more attractive to the person who's casually into a fitness regime, who's trying to lose a few pounds, but who doesn't want to be intimidated by the bodybuilder. So by pushing the bodybuilder away, they bring in the casual fitness person. They've done it very well, making trade-offs. Really key, but many firms don't do it. So could people imitate Trader Joe's? And why do trade-offs help make it difficult for others to imitate Trader Joe's? Well, consider the case of Kroger's, a large supermarket chain in the United States. They've made historical commitments that are rigid. They can't just change their entire store format to be able to mimic Trader Joe's. They've got large stores with wide aisles. They have many branded goods in their stores and relationships with the manufacturers of those branded goods. They have a strategy of offering sales each week. They can't easily shift to everyday low pricing. In other words, it's really hard for them to modify everything they do to imitate Trader Joe's. They're stuck with the set of choices they've made to some extent. Moreover, there's the issue of mindset. The mindset of people operating a typical grocery store, well, that's very different than the mindset of Trader Joe's leadership. It's hard to change mindset as well. Well, you might say, maybe the way to imitate Trader Joe's is by setting up a separate subsidiary within one of these large grocery chains and let them begin to build a chain of smaller format stores to compete directly with Trader Joe's. Well, the large and successful British retailer Tesco tried just that. They created a chain called Fresh and Easy, launched it in the western portion of the United States to compete with Trader Joe's. Smaller format, limited selection of items, very much in the spirit of a Trader Joe's. But was it as good as Trader Joe's? No. Tesco, like British Airways and United Airlines, and like IBM in our previous lectures, they straddled. They created something neither as good as Trader Joe's, nor as effective as their main business at Tesco. So one of the reasons making trade-offs works really well is because you make it very hard to be imitated because of the commitments that companies have made that they cannot easily change. And you tend to increase the chance that your competitors will end up straddling in an attempt to compete more effectively with you. The Trader Joe's strategy of making trade-offs, though, is more than just about making it hard for others to imitate them. It's also helped them mitigate some of the very negative forces in terms of the industry structure. The unique array of private label products unavailable at other retailers diminishes both buyer power and competitive rivalry. When you're not selling the same goods that Stop and Shop and Kroger's and others sell, well, then people can't compare on price, and you don't get dragged into price wars. The distinctive in-store experience mitigates both buyer power and rivalry, and it helps to counter the threat of substitutions from other retail formats, including e-commerce. You know, I asked one executive when I was running a workshop for a Fortune 500 company, I asked them about Trader Joe's. I was teaching a case study about the firm. And she said to me, I love the store. I go there every Saturday. It's my little Saturday morning vacation. Who would describe going shopping as a vacation? But at Trader Joe's, many customers do view it as an enjoyable experience. And by creating that experience, they've mitigated the threat of substitution from e-commerce to some extent. As for the everyday low pricing strategy, that minimizes price rivalry and buyer power as well. We're not in the business of having things on sale below cost to drag people in to then convince them to pay higher prices for certain items where we make our profit. They're not in that business. By having an everyday low price strategy, they minimize rivalry and buyer power. Mitigating negative forces is really key, and they do it in another way as well. Their willingness to alter their product mix frequently mitigates supplier power. Trader Joe's maintains a credible threat with regard to discontinuing products, as customers have come to understand that the product mix is highly dynamic. As a customer, I know that I may not see the same item I saw a month ago, and I've come to accept that as a customer of Trader Joe's. And the chain actually trains its employees to counsel me when I'm worried about the fact or I'm upset about the fact that my item is gone. And they're there to help you sample and try a new item that has replaced it. Suppliers don't have as much power if they know that that Trader Joe's simply doesn't have to have their item because they're willing to change and move to someone else's item over time. Popular items will come and go, and many suppliers find it difficult to argue customers will be upset if a product disappears from the shelf or if a different manufacturer provides it. But moreover, the secrecy of the fact that many customers don't know who makes these private label items for Trader Joe's makes it such that Trader Joe's can offer the very same item under the Trader Joe's moniker, under that brand, change its supplier to get a better price in the negotiating table, and you, the customer, has no knowledge of that. Finally, locating stores in old strip malls offsets the power of real estate firms and landlords that charge high rents to many retailers. So you can see by choosing the strategy as they have done, they've dealt with an industry where the five forces, frankly, aren't very good. It's not an attractive industry. It's tough. It's a fight for profits. But their choices have mitigated each of those five forces in a way that's enabled them to be successful. So why don't other firms make trade-offs like this? Why is it so hard for firms to make trade-offs? We've listed a few that have done it well, like Planet Fitness or eHarmony or Edward Jones. Why don't others do it? I think it's because of the growth trap. CEOs want to grow the top line. They want to grow revenue. And trade-offs can constrain growth. They are the one downside, right? Because as you make trade-offs, you narrow the scope of the firm. You narrow your target market. And narrowing your target market means it's more difficult to grow that top line, to grow sales aggressively. Plus, it's very hard to say no to customers. You know, making trade-offs means when the customer comes in and wants three or four other items that you don't have, you have to be willing to say, no, we don't carry those items. We don't carry those brands. Sorry, we don't have a loyalty card. That's a tough conversation for many managers to have. They hear the request from the customer and they want to please them. But by pleasing them, they find themselves moving in many different directions at once, not making the trade-offs that enable them to be distinctive from their competition. They follow the herd and become more like their competition, where they're constantly saying yes to new customer requests. Why are some firms and some CEOs so obsessed with growth, you might ask? Well, for publicly traded firms, there's definitely the pressure to meet Wall Street expectations. But also, you have to note that large firms typically offer higher compensation to their executives. You get more publicity if you run a large firm than a smaller firm. If you're Trader Joe's, you're privately held, you're fairly secretive, you don't see the CEO's face on the cover of Business Week or Fortune magazine. CEOs who become obsessed with growth often do so because it does lead to more publicity, a bigger empire that they get to lead, more compensation, and the like. There are some personal interests driving the obsession with growth for many companies. You know, there's a real challenge, though, when you offer such aggressive growth targets as a CEO. You have to ask yourself, you know, what does that mean when I say I want to grow at 15 or 20 or 25% a year? Let's think about that for a moment. Mathematicians have this rule of 72 that helps us think about growth of any number. So how long until a firm doubles in size? Well, if you take 72 and divide by the growth rate that firm aspires to achieve, you get the number of years it will take for that firm to double in size. So if a firm's trying to grow at 20% per year, it's going to take about 3.5 years for that firm to double in size. How is a firm that might have been around for 30, 40, 50 years going to double in size in such a short period of time? How are they going to achieve that aggressive target? Well, in many cases, what they begin to do is violate the key trade-offs that they originally made. So they began by having a long list of what they weren't going to do, things that made them distinct. But that created a very narrow target market. So how do you go beyond that? You begin to say, well, let's lop off a few of those trade-offs. Let's start doing a few things we didn't do in the past in pursuit of growth. Some have said that this is what Southwest Airlines has been doing recently, beginning to walk away from a few of those trade-offs because they saturated the market that they first set out to dominate in the United States. And so in looking for new growth, they've started to walk away from a few of those trade-offs. And maybe that's meant they're not quite as distinct as they used to be. The airline understands this, and they've pushed back on some of that criticism. It's been interesting to watch the dialogue between those who see them as violating some trade-offs and the managers there who see themselves as making smart choices to try to continue to grow. One other point about Trader Joe's that's interesting. Some point to them as an example of dual advantage. They're one of the rare cases, perhaps, where they've achieved differentiation and low cost simultaneously. Is that true? Well, I think the reference point here is crucial. If one compares Trader Joe's to a typical supermarket, you might say that they have slightly higher prices. Maybe they are premium and they have lower costs. But if you compare them to other organic or natural stores like Whole Foods, well, clearly their prices are lower, and therefore it's hard to argue that they're a differentiated player. Perhaps they are low cost, but not differentiated at the same time. Bottom line is, with Trader Joe's, it's hard to come to a definitive conclusion with regard to this issue of dual advantage because they're not a publicly traded company. We don't have their financial data. Moreover, because they offer private label goods, it's very hard to even assess the price level at the firm. Are their prices higher or lower than XYZ competitor? We're not quite sure because the products are not identical in both locations. This issue of dual advantage is interesting because many people come to a misguided view of the meaning of generic strategies. They confuse the term differentiation with the general notion of being different than the competition. It's important to note that low-cost players can be highly distinctive. Think Dell in its heyday or Southwest. But that doesn't mean they're differentiated in the precise way that Porter initially defined the term. In the original generic strategies framework, differentiation meant creating a larger wedge between willingness to pay and costs than the average rival by raising willingness to pay much higher than the average competitor while incurring somewhat higher costs. So many times people point to a firm and say they're both differentiated and low cost, but in fact they're not differentiated. They're not charging a premium price. They're just really different than other firms. And this makes it difficult when people misinterpret the framework. But whether you misinterpret it or not, the bottom line is Trader Joe's is a very interesting firm because at a minimum, it's a tremendous low-cost player with a unique store experience. And perhaps there's even a bit of differentiation there as well in some cases. Now, this brings us to an alternative point of view on strategy articulated by Kim and Mauborn in a book, Blue Ocean Strategy. They wrote it in strict contrast to the work of Porter and his view of strategy. They argued that dual advantage is not only possible, it's much more prevalent in the world than Porter came to admit. That true innovators are able to break this trade-off between low cost and differentiation. They're able to create a new value proposition where they can, in fact, deliver both. And they point, for example, at one firm, one innovator, that they claim has done this very well. Cirque du Soleil. Cirque du Soleil, this hybrid between a circus and a Broadway show. This elaborate production. They charge a premium price, yet the authors argue they have lower costs than the typical circus. One point, they haven't really articulated the evidence behind that assertion on cost. On the issue of premium price, we all know that they do, in fact, charge a premium price relative to circuses. So Cirque du Soleil is their example of a company they would argue that didn't have to make a choice, that was able to achieve dual advantage. One weakness is some of their other examples, I think, don't measure up. Southwest, they offer as an example of a blue ocean strategy company. But I would argue that's not dual advantage. There's no premium price there. There's a low cost player that's different, that's distinct, but not differentiated in the sense that they have higher willingness to pay than many of their rivals. How do you create this blue ocean strategy firm, this firm that can break the paradigm in an industry and perhaps achieve dual advantage? They argue that what you have to do is think about what the typical firm in the industry is good at and not so good at, and flip that on its head. Can we be great at things that typical firms in the industry aren't doing very well? And can we sacrifice or cut down on things that other firms are investing a lot in? Maybe we won't do that. So at Cirque du Soleil, we'll invest in choreography and the composition of beautiful music, things that the typical circus doesn't do as much of. But we'll cut back. We won't have animals, and we won't have star performers. And by making those choices, we flip the industry on its head and create a very different kind of company, one that doesn't even have a direct competitor. How beautiful is that? Whether you're Trader Joe's or you're Cirque du Soleil, when you can't even identify a direct competitor very easily, well, now you know you have a great strategy. So Kim and Mauborn, in their book, Blue Ocean Strategy, ask four questions. They call it the four actions framework to help people think about how they might redefine an industry, how they might come up with a strategy that sets it apart from many competitors. They say, first ask yourself, what can we not do that others are doing? What can we eliminate that others are doing? What can we reduce that others are doing a lot of, we'll do less of? But also we can ask, what can we create and enhance? What are some things that others aren't doing at all that we could do? Or what are they doing a little bit of that we could do a lot more of? So what can we create and enhance? What can we reduce and eliminate? The four key questions, the four key actions to help us build a truly innovative strategy. Well, how different is that view actually than Porter? Many people who study strategy think of these two sets of authors as really in direct contrast to one another. But I would argue, in fact, these models have a lot in common. You should recognize rather quickly that trade-offs represent a common element to the work of Porter or the Blue Ocean Strategy authors. In their own way, each scholar emphasizes the importance of not doing some key things that many traditional players are doing. By eschewing certain activities that are commonplace in an industry, firms create a distinctive position that's hard to imitate. The Blue Ocean Strategy framework, in short, has much more in common with Porter's perspective than many people recognize initially. I like the framework from Blue Ocean Strategy because it does ask you good questions. It asks good questions that can help you sharpen your distinctiveness relative to other firms. In the end, it's all about being distinctive. That's the key. So has Google, for example, have they reduced or eliminated things that other search portals did? They certainly did. They stripped down their homepage to something so simple. But they enhanced the search capability a great deal and offered something others did not. So in a way, their strategy fits the framework very nicely. So the framework can be helpful in helping us ask good questions to coming up with a better strategy. Now, one of the problems, I think, and why firms don't have distinctive strategies, why they end up so much like their competition, is they do a lot of benchmarking. And what happens when you benchmark? You typically look for the things you're doing much less effectively than the competition, and you try to catch up to them. Let's get as good as them on an item where we're lagging behind. Of course, that competitor, they're doing the very same thing. They're benchmarking you. They're looking at where they're behind and trying to catch up. But if you catch up to them on issue A, and they catch up to you on issue C, at the end of the day, the two of you have become much more alike. Benchmarking leads to the homogenization of strategies. Benchmarking leads to less effective strategies in some cases. Not to say you shouldn't study the competition, but maybe you want to amplify what you do differently, more so than you just always want to play catch up. Youngmin Moon is a marketing professor at Harvard Business School, and she has said that she has seen convergence in many industries, rivals becoming more and more alike. And she says in many cases, what she sees as she walks through the aisles of a grocery store or an apparel retailer, she says, I see heterogeneous homogeneity. In other words, on the face of it, I see diversity. But underneath it all, I see a lot of homogeneity. So in the bottled water market, she says, as I walk down the aisle, I see many different brands, many different flavors of water, many different pack sizes. And at the end of the day, it's all water. It's still a commodity. It's not truly differentiated. But all those things they've done to create many varieties of the same basic product, she says that's an expensive route to commoditization. It's truly convergence, not distinctiveness. So what are some of the lessons here for us? Strategy rests on unique activities. And to create a sustainable strategic position, you have to make trade-offs. Without making those trade-offs, your ideas can be imitated and you won't be able to sustain the advantage. So you have to be able to choose what not to do. That's really crucial. And that's tough. Because for many of us, we're not willing to make those tough choices at times. not willing to say no to certain customers or no to certain activities, in part because we want to achieve that top-line growth. So your homework at the end of this lecture: select a firm you think has been very successful in a particular industry and ask yourself, what trade-offs has the company made so as to distinguish itself from its rivals? Can you find a firm like Planet Fitness or Trader Joe's and analyze them? But then turn to a firm that you've seen try to pursue rapid growth, but maybe who's seen its distinctiveness erode recently, and ask yourself, what trade-offs has that company violated as it's pursued all that revenue growth?
This lecture is titled First Movers versus Fast Followers.
In this lecture, I would like to challenge an important and commonly held view about strategy. Many entrepreneurs, many companies believe that being first is crucial. You have to be first to market. They believe there's tremendous advantage from being first to market. Is that true? Should we believe that conventional wisdom? That's what I'd like to look at in this lecture. What do we mean by first mover advantage? We mean the competitive advantage established by virtue of the fact that a company has entered a market first and established a position. And yes, first movers sometimes do achieve tremendous advantage. Let's take a few examples. Gillette in razors. Sony in portable stereos with its Walkman product. Coca-Cola in carbonated soft drinks. Hoover in vacuum cleaners. Each of those firms was first to market in their category or early to market in their category, and they seem to achieve a tremendous advantage by being early to market. But it's not always the case that first movers win. We certainly do have plenty of examples of first movers who did not succeed, or even who ended up completely out of the market. Who was the first, or at least one of the very early players in social media? It was not Facebook. It was a company called Friendster, one many of you may not even recall. What about the first mover in VCRs, video cassette recorders? That would be Sony. But they bet on Beta, and VHS became the technological standard. Sony did not become the winner, despite being the first mover. What about the first mover in internet retailing? Do you remember eToys? They were very early, moving to the web and offering products without any physical stores. What about internet browsers? Do you remember Netscape? Search. Was Google first? No, they were not. One study, in fact, showed that pioneers were more successful than late movers in just 15 of 50 product categories. That is what research coming out of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern has shown. First mover advantage, where does it come from? What are the causes of the situations where first movers do have advantage? Well, there are four major things that we can think about that help incumbents have advantage: economies of scale, economies of scope, network effects, and learning effects. We're going to talk about each of those in turn. Let's delve into them a bit. What does it mean for a firm to have economies of scale? What does it mean to have a learning advantage? What is a network effect? And might there also be some source of first mover advantage from preempting access to scarce resources or assets? So maybe you get the key locations or talented employees or key suppliers first. So these are all potential sources of first mover advantage. If scale matters, if learning matters, if network effects matter, and if getting access to key assets is key, all of those might be the basis for first mover advantage. What do we mean by economies of scale? Economies of scale exist in a business when the cost per unit to produce and distribute that good fall as you produce more units of the good in any given time period. So the bigger, the better. The larger you are, the more your costs per unit come down. That's what we mean by economies of scale. And we can think of a number of businesses where such scale economies are pronounced. Toyota in the automobile business, right? Their size and scale enables them to have lower costs of production than smaller firms. Bank of America and commercial banking, there are certain efficiencies that come from being a large, nationwide, and global financial institution. Or even FedEx, for example, which operates a logistics company. Again, there's huge technological investments and infrastructure investments in that business. And anytime you see these huge investments that have to be made, these very high fixed costs, well, the higher your volume, the more you're able to amortize those fixed costs over many units and bring your cost per unit down. That's what we mean by economies of scale. Well, what about the learning curve? How is that different, a learning curve effect, from a scale effect? Well, in the case of a learning curve, what you have is, again, cost per unit falling, but this time not because you produce more units today, but because you've been producing this good over some extended period of time. And over time, you've become more experienced at producing this good. You've learned how to do it more efficiently, and so your cost per unit fall over time. They fall as the total number of units you've ever produced continues to grow. And we see this, for example, in the submarine manufacturing business. One of my first jobs in the private sector was at General Dynamics, maker of the Trident, 688, and Seawolf submarines when I was there. And what we learned as we were projecting our costs on future submarine contracts is we knew there was a significant learning curve. When we produced the first Trident submarine, the cost to produce that was quite high. But our workers became more and more familiar with the boat, and they were able to bring costs down on each subsequent ship. We learned. Our experience gave us great benefit. So whether it's economies of scale or learning curves, in each case, the incumbent has the advantage. If you can get in there first, you can bring your costs down because you can get bigger faster and you can get more experience faster before other players enter the business. But there's another key source of competitive advantage, a first mover advantage that we need to discuss. And that's what we call network effects. This one is less understood, perhaps, by many business people than the issues of scale economies or learning curves. Network effects have less to do with cost.